Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuc, the producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president, CEO, and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing news items from the previous week. On Wednesday, September 15th, Joe Donahue and Alan Chartok were joined by UAlbany adjunct professor and investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
Kudos to Bob Woodward, really. The new book is Peril. It is by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, and it comes out, I believe, next Tuesday, and the book is already starting to make the press rounds, and there is much information that is being released in early copies of the book that is making news, as Alan mentioned a moment ago. The top headline grabber is the fact that there were two secret phone calls that General Mark Milley, who yesterday in a press release, the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, referred to as a, quote, dumbass, said that the so Milley, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, assured his Chinese counterpart, General Li of the People's Liberation Army, that the United States would not strike, according to the new book. One call took place on October 30th, 4 days before the election that unseated President Donald Trump, and the other on January 8th, 2 days after the Capitol siege carried out his supporters. The first call was prompted by Milley's review of intelligence suggesting that the Chinese believed that the U.S. was preparing to attack. That belief, the authors write, was based on tensions over military exercises in the South China Sea and deepened by Trump's belligerent rhetoric toward China. General Li, I want to assure you that the American government is stable and everything is going to be okay, Milley told him. We are not going to attack or conduct any kinetic operations against you. In the book's account, Milley went so far as to pledge he would alert his counterpart in the event of a U.S. attack, stressing the rapport they'd established through a back channel. General Li, you and I have known each other for now 5 years. If we're going to attack, I'm going to call you ahead of time. It's not going to be a surprise. Li did take the chairman at his words, according to the authors of the book. It is the second phone call that went a little not as well, placed to address Chinese fears about the events of January 6th. Li was not easily assuaged, even after Milley promised him, we are 100% steady, everything's fine, but democracy can be sloppy sometimes. oh, the lipstick on that pig. The other thing that I would like to, while we're talking about this, that I thought was just extraordinary was the conversation that Milley also had with the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. The authors obtained a transcript of the call, Pelosi telling Milley, referring to Trump, he's crazy, you know he's crazy, and what he did yesterday, meaning January 6th, is further evidence of his craziness. Milley replied, I agree with you on everything.
First of all, Pelosi is just such a heroine, and I just hope she changes her mind about retiring at the end of this, because she has more guts in her finger than most politicians ever do. She faced up to the president, the ex-president, said all roads lead to Putin with you, and that was true, but this is a real conundrum if you think about it. I mean, the idea, we've always believed in civilian control of the military. And here, many of us are applauding Milley, I'm one of them, for having said, no, we're not going to allow you to manipulate, you know, the election returns by firing off a nuke, starting a war. And it also raises the question, of the principle that the executive controls the military. Because believe me, it could be the other way around, and that would be even worse. What if General MacArthur, for example, had been allowed to, arm his people with nukes, and we had them, and go into China or go into Russia? He didn't. He wasn't allowed to do that. And it cost Harry Truman an awful lot of popularity. So it's a fascinating setup.
Bob Griffin, in this article and the releases from the book, they report that Milley's resolve was deepened by the events of June 1st, 2020, when he felt Trump had used him as part of a photo op in his walk across Lafayette Square during protests that began after the killing of George Floyd. The chairman came to see his role as ensuring that, quote, we're not going to turn our guns on the American people and we're not going to have a wag the dog scenario overseas. Milley at one point did become alarmed, saying this is a highly dangerous situation. We are not going to lash out for, he says, what, are we going to lash out for his ego?
Yeah, Joe, I mean, there's so much to unpack with this. You know, it seems like everybody in the world, with the exception of the Trump supporters, saw the insurrection on January 6th for what it was, and the instability that it showed both to us in this country, but to everybody around the world, I think basically shook all of the governments to its core, because even the Chinese that are not our friends depend on a certain level of stability in the American form of government, and that was stripped away from us on January 6th. I to this day and will continue to say that I hope that criminal charges are brought up against Donald J. Trump and that he is forever forbidden from running for office again. I think he is a clear and present danger to the future of democracy. And honestly, Joe, I don't understand how anyone can support him who supports either the rule of law or the military, although you see all sort of the jingoistic garbage that comes out of some of his supporters. You know, Alan, you raised some really complex and difficult questions, right? Because there has to be a balance of power, and you never want the executive to be able to act unilaterally. That's why there should be a requirement of congressional at least approval or consent in order to go to war. The concern you have, though, is that you also need an executive that can allow the military to move quickly as a deterrence, you know, in case we're viewed as we're facing, you know, a first strike capability. So you don't want to bog them down. But at the same time, I think we had a better practice when civilian control of the military included that no generals or admirals or flag officers could be Secretary of State, that they had you had to be a civilian. I think we need to go back to that.
So much of that depends, though, on the character of the people involved. I mean, you can have a constitutional arrangement of who has power over whom, but the real problem is if you have a Donald J. Trump as president, that could change everything, as opposed to a Milley who turns out to be an American hero.
Yeah, the fish rots from the head, right, Alan? I've heard you say that many, many times.
Well,
it
usually rots from the head.
Yeah, this is an example. It's also an example of, and I hope people don't lose sight of this, of our civil servants, and this includes the general, who put themselves in their careers on the line to uphold their oath to office and to this country. And I know it's great sport in this country to malign government employees and government workers. But this is a prime example of why character matters, but also the sacrifice that other Americans are willing to make in order to make sure that we are all safe.
Yep. Rosemary,
you want to hear another view?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So I actually think that Trump and Rubio are right about this general. He was a dumbass, or he would never have appeared at that publicity stunt. And I think he's been trying to make up for that ever since. And Rubio is right. If we had been to war, whether the reason was good or not, if America was at war with China and he was warning them, that is an act of treason. I agree with him on that. And what this really has exposed is that our laws are governing the relationship between government, civilian government, and military need to be fixed. And we knew this, and nothing has happened about it. Trump as president, had sole power to unleash nuclear power. And that's not changed. Biden has announced. So we like his character better, so suddenly it's okay? I don't think so. It should be harder to start a war. It should be harder to launch a nuclear weapon. And Congress has done nothing to fix that. I think that's really what's at stake here. And I see a whole lot of this. How did Woodward get this access to Milley? I think he totally has been out to improve his reputation since that baloney with the Bible and the demonstration and the George Floyd. And this is not good. There's no way that this is a good action. Where you disagree with the president, you disagree with his state of mind. We have the 25th Amendment on that, which we also did not use, and it needs to be shorn up too. That's how you get rid of a president with bad character and instability, not by having the generals go behind their back. I think this is incredibly dangerous.
It seems, go ahead.
But Rosemary, I have a question for you. So if a general learns that a president, in order to foster his own power, is going to potentially send a nuke, and you are quite right that we have, and I raised this before, we have an arrangement of powers, but don't you think that Milley was wrong to do what he did?
I think it was arguably an act of treason. Your government, had the circumstances come about, we're at war with China, and it may be indeed that it's because Trump just wanted to, he's nuts and unstable and all the bad reasons that we've talked about. But we are at war. That is an official American position. And our general is calling the enemy and saying, we're about to attack you, ruining surprise or whatever it is. That is, on the face of it, treason. And well, the reasons, I get it. We've been talking about that. And those need to be fixed. But to make Milley a hero and say this is all Trump, that's really not a good position.
Bob?
Yeah, but in order to be a war, Rosemary, by our Constitution, it would have had to go before Congress, and the Congress would have had to vote. So it's not a surprise. What Milley said was that we weren't going to launch a preemptive strike. All right, but if it was a war that was declared legally, then he would have fought it. And I also push back with you about Milley's role on the walk across. He was ordered to do so, and from everything that I have read, is that he was taken by surprise from that. But he's not going to buck his commander in chief in front of everybody and say, "No, I'm not walking with you." So I'm sorry. I think you're way off base on this.
Well, okay, why was he in uniform? Why was he in, a military uniform in the middle of a protest? I just don't think he's a hero. I understand your point. I'm not trying to be, completely a jerk about this, but I think that the attention that this is bringing ought to bring about changes in our law, not in more yelling about how bad Trump was.
Judy Patrick.
So there are a lot of parallels being drawn today or this morning between what Milley did and what Jim Schlesinger did in the final days of the Nixon presidency,
right,
where Nixon was walking around the White House drunk and sobbing, and there was concern about what he might do. But after that, they did upgrade the 25th Amendment, and that was at our disposal. It is a shame. We shouldn't have to rely on our military leaders to save us from ourselves. That being said, I think Axios had the political website. Jonathan Swan writes for them. He has some good behind-the-scene reporting, extra reporting on this. And he notes that Esper, the defense secretary, had sent back channel messages to China at the same time because there was grave concern that China was misreading what was happening, and they were concerned that China was preparing for a counterattack, thinking that the U.S. was going to attack them, and that there were real urgency between the U.S. and China in the back channel arena to make sure nothing like this happened. Milley's supposed to testify September 28th before the Senate Armed Services Committee. It's supposed to be about the Afghanistan withdrawal, but you can bet this is going to be the primary topic of conversation. And I love it because let's get more detail about what happened in those final days and what exactly prompted him to do the things he did.
What you always have to do is imagine the worst possible case. Worst possible case is that it is discovered that the president using his sole power to do this, wants to unleash a nuke onto China. Let's just say that, that's going on. Are you telling me that that a chief military man, the head of the Joint Chiefs, shouldn't step in and do everything in their power to prevent the loss of millions of lives and the destruction of a good deal of America? Are you kidding?
And it doesn't necessarily have to be true, right? I mean, even if you say that, you know, I'll call you first. You're trying to calm them down, right?
Yeah. And he was saying that they weren't going to do a sneak attack. Two right. points. One, I've never been in a formal meeting where the military weren't wearing their uniforms. Okay. So the idea of the reason he was in uniform was you know, I take that off the table. The other point that I want everybody to remember is that Trump purposefully undermined the appointment process, and Congress went along with it, so that he had acting people in positions who weren't even confirmed. So even that in my mind was undermining Article 25. The point that the Senate and Congress allowed Trump to put people in positions of power without going through the proper confirmation. So you had all of these acting positions, which in my mind was done purposefully to undermine any attempt to invoke an Article 25 movement to replace him. I mean, think about all of the acting positions that were in place on the 6th. I mean, actually, think about all of the positions in the cabinet that never even received a confirmed leader. I mean, so that this is actually another problem with the Article 25 of the Constitution that really needs to be addressed, so that the president can't undermine the overall democracy by just not following through and putting people for appointment. This also, Joe, is a problem with Congress. And, you know, in Congress has aided and abetted, particularly the Republicans, aided and abetted Donald Trump in undermining this country.
Rosemary.
Well, I agree with that, but there's a certain speciousness to your argument here that Milley was so naive, let's say, or blindly obedient that he goes marching off with Trump to run out protests and to, you know, that whole fiasco with George Floyd. And then suddenly he becomes so wise and intuitive about what Trump was doing that he could unilaterally take on the future of our relations with China. That's messed up too. And I go back to, you're right, it is Congress, and this was not a good Congress. They certainly did help Trump, but that's where the real fix is. There has to be a fix in the 25th Amendment, the recall of a president, if you will, and there has to be a fix in who gets to decide about war. And you're right about the declared wars too. You know, none of the wars we've had recently, not Iraq, not Afghanistan, those were not wars that got an act of Congress. And yet, would it not have been treason if Milley had done this in the middle of one of those wars? So it's all very, very blurred now. And everybody is playing by their own sets of rules. And that is dangerous. And you can't just decide what's right and wrong based on if you like Trump or not.
I think the last war that was the Tonkin Resolution for Vietnam, right? So I don't disagree with you. I think Congress has for decades now abridged their fiduciary responsibilities, and they are to fault. You are absolutely correct, and again, we can change that at the ballot box.
Bob Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, September 15th. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed or evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Thank you. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Thursday, September 16th, Alan Chartok was off in observance of Yom Kippur. Joe Donahue was joined by Albany City Chief Auditor Dorothea Pleers, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics Vera Acarius-Kelly, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York State Press Association, Judy Patrick.
Many members of the women's gymnastics team testified yesterday and basically ripped into the FBI for botching the case against Larry Nassar, who sexually abused hundreds of women and girls. Ultimately, the FBI Director Christopher Wray apologized for inexcusable failures in the investigation. Sitting at a witness table alongside three of her former gymnastics teammates, Simone Biles broke down in tears while explaining to a Senate committee that she doesn't want any more young people to experience the kind of suffering she endured at the hands of Lawrence Nassar, the former national team doctor. To be clear, I blame Larry Nassar, but I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated this abuse, said Ms. Biles, who is 24 years old. She said this as her mother, Nellie Biles, sat nearby, dabbing her eyes with a tissue. Ms. Biles and hundreds of other girls and women, including a majority of the members of the 2012 and 2016 U.S. Olympic women's gymnastic teams, were molested by Mr. Nassar, who is now serving what amounts to life in prison for multiple sex crimes. His serial molestation is at the center of one of the biggest child sex abuse cases in American history. Michaela Maroney, an Olympian in 2012, also testified, describing in detail how Mr. Nassar repeatedly abused her, even at the London Games, where she won a gold medal. She said she survived a harrowing ordeal when she and Mr. Nassar were at a competition in Tokyo, certain she was going to die that night because there was no way that he was going to let me go. Not only did the FBI not report my abuse, but when they eventually documented my report 17 months later, they made entirely false claims about what I had said, Ms. Maroney testified. They chose to lie about what I said and protect a serial child molester rather than protect not only me, but countless others. In a remarkable turn, the FBI Director Christopher Wray acknowledged the agency's mishandling of the case and apologized to the victims. Judy, how does that happen under the FBI's watch of just such a horrendous and what I would think, you know, basically an open secret amongst the Olympic community?
Right, and we should note that it was journalism that eventually brought this to light and made it stop like it should have years before. And one of the things I took away from yesterday was the idea that the FBI agent who initially handled this, he just got fired last week.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to shoot from the hip and not know all the information. Maybe there was a procedure they had to follow. But this person has been in the employ of the FBI all this time. Nassar was convicted, what was it, last year or the year before? Why has it taken so long for the FBI to deal with this? And then the supervisor of the FBI was able to retire. The gymnasts now are asking, they want a little bit more justice, and they would like to see these people criminally charged. The Justice Department officials weren't at the hearing yesterday, and you could hear the gymnasts say, why aren't they here? They will be at a later hearing, I guess later this month. But those are, you know, serious questions. I think that we did a huge disservice to those young women. I mean, we're talking about girls. There were young women, but there were girls. They're 12 or 13 years old who were abused by this man. It's a horrible, horrible nightmare, and I am shocked. It's not that it never happens, because I have seen it in my life. Local police departments, they for many years they didn't know how to handle these kinds of cases. They would say, oh, it's not that bad. You heard one of the gymnasts say that yesterday. She was told, oh, is it really that bad? Well, women or assault victims have gotten this for decades. The situation has improved, but I would have thought in 2021 we would be past this by now, but we're still dealing with these issues.
You know, I remember just a few years ago, Ali Raisman, who is an Olympic gymnast and was testified yesterday as well. She was at University at Albany speaking, and was speaking to a group of young gymnasts, and my kids, I think my niece was one of the kids there, and she was I think 12 or 13 at the time. And somebody asked the question of, you know, did nobody know what was going on? And Allie Raceman looked at the kids and she said, you know, I think even you guys know that others should find it odd that an adult man wants to spend his non-working time with children. And that just really struck me, that there's a culture there and that nobody saw it, and even if they did, no attention was paid to it. And certainly, and I thought back of that yesterday as I was hearing these accounts of, yes, you go and even with the FBI involved, they don't do anything about it. Vera?
To me, what, you know, of course I agree with what Julie said and what you just, you know, conveyed. What stood out to me, in addition to all the testimony, was, you know, the fact that so Christopher Wray, head of the FBI, apologizes,
yeah,
which is, you know, a thoughtful gesture. But what's more important to me is to figure out how this all happened.
Exactly.
And how the FBI allowed these agents to operate this way, to lie about what was said, to not file reports, to then retire. What is the training like for FBI agents? Why are they, apparently, from what we know, so callous and dismissive of young women's testimony? What is going on there that is fundamentally important to figure out? So an apology is a starting point, but not an end point. And I think it's very important for us to figure out what went wrong within the FBI organization. We have certain ideas of what's wrong. Young women perhaps not being taken seriously, or perceived as, you know, overly emotional, or not responding well to the stress of competing on the international level. Whatever those kinds of frames are that are used to portray young women as not believable, that needs to be investigated, and the training for FBI agents needs to be adjusted. And we need to figure out a better way of training agents and holding them responsible for when they make fundamental, horrific mistakes like these that led to hundreds of additional girls being abused. I mean, it is shocking to the core. So that is what the questions are. We need to investigate what went wrong and how it went wrong and how we can change the fundamental principles that obviously are in place at the FBI to this day.
It strikes me, too, that, you know, Simone Biles was testifying, and you have to do a mental note, because she has been in the public eye for so long, she's still only 23 years old. And in some cases, when this abuse happened, 12, 13 years old. That is, I mean, at any age, what happened to them is atrocious. But to put girls in that situation is also just a horrible crime. And you know, I think, yes, the FBI, but I think the whole system has to be looked at to figure out how, why they are so vulnerable to just this, you know, for one, well, I don't know that there is a better term than monster. Dorsey.
Yeah, I'm listening to you all, and I reflect on watching Simone give her testimony, and she pauses and she has her moment and she starts crying. And, you know, I apologize if this is a trigger for anyone, but you know, I think we lose sight of how many women, girls, and I don't want to exclude boys and men, but in particular in this context, women and girls have experienced some form of abuse, molestation, because it is a very isolating experience. And so many women and girls never say a word. Right. And I'll give the quick example. I was in college. I was accepted into a summer fellowship at Johns Hopkins, and my parents dropped me off, and I said, oh, I'm going to tour the neighborhood around the campus. And so I set off by myself, and I'm walking down the street, and I see a man coming towards me, and I didn't think anything of it, and I'm walking, and he reached out and grabbed my left breast and took off running. And I just remember being so shocked that I couldn't move. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know whether to yell, scream, run. And you lose a piece of your innocence. And that's one instance that I would feel comfortable sharing on the air. But we talk about these failed systems and lose sight of the fact that all of these young women and so many others, their innocence is stripped, and they have to live with this every day. It never goes away. And so while this pedophile is now going to serve time, these young women are serving time with him because the scars of what he did never goes away. And so as someone who has a daughter, it is deeply concerning that as she goes out into the world, this is her lived reality,
right?
Being a girl, being a woman in this society, because we have a failed system. It has and continues to be a system that allows perpetrators to thrive and continue to do what they've done forever. And I think this underscores the significance of the Me Too movement, because it's fundamentally shifting social and cultural norms in this country when it comes to molesting women, being abusive of women, and not, again, not just women. So, you know, I don't want to underscore the impact that this will have on the women in this case for their lifetime.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking, you make such a good point, Dorsey, because of the, I was thinking of when people were talking about Simone Biles and during the Olympics, and, you know, she was having, she said she needed a timeout for her mental health and so forth. And people were saying, oh, come on, you can do it. And I just thought, you know, what these women have been through, and they're all victims, everyone on that team. And it just, the fact that, you know, we don't even really think about and take that into consideration of what they have been through. And even the fact of just going back into competition has to be incredibly triggering, I would think, and still having to talk about it as well, which I know is important, but yet still is very hard, as you say, and I think you said it beautifully, was that, yeah, they're doing time too for the rest of their life.
I just want us to think about the idea that any time any of these young women go to see a physician for the rest of their lives.
Yes.
They will experience anxiety, panic attacks. They might engage in avoidance behavior to not see a physician, or a person in a position of authority who they no longer believe they can trust, right? This is true for abuse within religious institutions or any kind of well-organized structure, right? But, I mean, the anxiety, lifelong anxiety and stress, and the mechanisms you as an individual have to develop to actually function fully in society to overcome some of those constant fears. It's just a horrendous burden that we often don't reflect on to the extent that we should, I think.
Agreed. And the other thing, too, Judy, as much as we talk about this, and I your point was not lost on me about how it was journalism that brought us the story. So, I mean, we can only extrapolate and assume that this is happening still and is happening with other people in power. And, you know, how do we suss that out as soon as possible so you don't have to have another situation like this, anything to this magnitude.
Right, and keep in mind that these were the Olympic gold medal gymnasts, you know, something we're all so proud of. But there are thousands and thousands of young women and young men who are abused every day, and
right.
They aren't getting that kind of attention, and they aren't getting that kind of, I mean, the gymnasts were terribly hurt, but there are a lot of, this happens to a lot of people, and
yeah.
It's easy to sweep some of those cases under the rug, and that needs to stop. And I think one of the reasons these women stepped forth yesterday, and that itself must have been very traumatic. But I think they're talking about this needs to stop for gymnasts, this needs to stop for athletes, but this needs to stop for humans, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's what for them made it worth going through the trauma, because I'm sure they're going to be traumatized after talking before the Senate. Can you imagine testifying before the Senate?
No.
I mean, it would be very traumatic. So
yeah.
There are a lot of these cases. They don't all deal with, you know, high profile, gold, you know, Olympic gymnasts. It was incredibly horrible that this happened to such a large number of these gymnasts, but it does happen to people who of all stripes.
Anne writes to us and says, women and girls all over the world are doing time for sexual abuse for various people, in this case, the FBI, neglecting their plight, the seriousness of what they will have to live with for the rest of their lives. I myself am a sexual abuse survivor, so I know what it feels like to live every day with the memories of those experiences. The lack of acknowledgement that my and all of these girls and women's feelings matter. Why are there no consequences for the FBI? Why are none of these people being prosecuted for their negligence? Why are none of them in jail? An apology is not nearly enough. That from Anne. Susan writes, wondering how the money involved in these programs would be threatened by authorities acknowledging their traumas in real time. Dave writes, is it really surprising that the FBI remains ensconced in the culture of J. Edgar Hoover and all that he wrought? Rosemary says that the FBI needs to have interviewers trained in sexual abuse techniques. Where was Child Protective Services? New York City has an incident response team protocol that is shared with law enforcement. There are joint interviews conducted. This team of law enforcement, child protective workers, and child advocacy experts work together. This joint approach reduces trauma and could have prevented this situation. The FBI is not trained to do this type of work. Expertise is needed.
One of the issues here was the FBI didn't even bother to refer it to someone else. Even if they didn't think they wanted to handle it, they could have at least referred it to a local authority, and they didn't do that.
Got this from a listener who said, odd that a non-working man wants to spend time with his children. To paraphrase what Joe said, I help once a week with a religion class and coach youth soccer. My kids are part of those programs, so I believe in contributing. The statement made by Joe was way too broad. I was quoting Allie Reisman, but okay. I wish I had more time to help with the players that struggle more, because when they aren't as good as I see it as a failure as a coach, Nasser and the FBI agents who are negligent should share cells for the rest of their lives. But there are good people who believe in service. So broad a statement should make every guy predator having to prove he's innocent. We should all have a reasonable approach as parents. I think that, again, the point that Allie was making at the time in talking to young girls was that you have to ask the question of if they have a choice of going out with people their own age in their free time. This is not to say that someone who is a youth leader is bad, but to say that someone who is working with children is then wanting to spend time with children
that isn't seen as odd and something that is questioned, especially when there have already been reports. The New York Times story that I read said, you know, there was a cloud of suspicion around him for years within the Olympic Committee. So with that, hopefully somewhat of a clarification. Anybody want?
And also maybe,
yeah,
Joe, I can just add, it's fairly standard practice that you don't spend extended periods of time by yourself,
right,
with groups of children. It, you know, you should have a collaborator, another person in the room, just in case you are protected as well as the children. So this is standard practice in educational environments, and I think it's something to think about. You know, what is the best approach to making sure that everyone is safe and well respected, and the conduct is appropriate.
Yes, and I would just say, you know, we can't let the U.S. Olympics off the hook here.
Not at all.
Oftentimes, when there is a perpetrator, people know it is not a secret. It's discussed in behind closed doors. And so the fact that he was allowed to continue to travel and be left alone with these girls, there's a lot of blame to go around, the FBI included, but also looking at the culture within that these young girls and young women, their parents, their families entrusted them with this institution, and they were very vulnerable, and someone should have been protecting them.
Dorothea Pliers on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, September 16th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday's show, Joe Donahue and Alan Chartok were joined by former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Siena College professor of economics, Aaron Pasitti, and Albany County district attorney, David Soares.
We go to the story on the consumer price index, and also ultimately, I think we can, I don't know, I'm going to ask Aaron what he thinks, but I think we can merge the two stories, can't we, Aaron, about also what's going on in this social, the economics of social, of the social safety net, and what that can and could do for us in both positive and negative ways. So, but the consumer price index story specifically, that prices climbed more slowly in August, which was welcome news for the Fed. Aaron, take it away.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. yeah, so you can start your lighter show now. So, yes, these two stories are they're only related in that politicians are creating a theater that makes them related. So I'll expand on that in a little bit. So this was a somewhat encouraging inflation report, and it's kind of weird to economists that all of a sudden inflation is taking center stage, because really since the mid-1980s, inflation has not been an issue. policymakers have done an exceptionally good job in keeping inflation right around the Federal Reserve's 2% target. So the fact that it has gone to 5.3% in August is somewhat alarming when you look at the historical perspective, but it's a lot less alarming when you think about the short-term factors that are driving it. So what inflation is it's just a measure of the increase in the cost of living. So it measures the, you know, the prices of all of the goods consumers buy, and then it looks at how much they've changed over time. So inflation is the same thing as the cost of living. So it was 5.3% on an annualized basis in August, and that's down from the 5.4% in July. So it's not a major decrease, but we've had two consecutive months where inflation has grown at a slower rate. And that lends a lot of support to the idea that this inflation is temporary. It's been caused by the most extreme supply chain and production disruption since World War II. You know, the world economy literally shut down for most of 2020. So trying to for businesses that are trying to reboot production, that takes a lot of work. And all businesses are trying to do that at the same time to meet, you know, consumer demand. So what's happening is, you know, businesses are bidding up the prices for shipping containers. Businesses are bidding up the prices for steel and lumber so that they can ramp up production to get back to where they were before the pandemic started. You can't do that on a national scale without running into some bottlenecks where, you know, some goods, you know, like lumber in the spring and steel today are just going to be in short supply. So these price changes are largely going to continue to moderate with some fluctuations, probably over the next year or so. The story of this report is energy, that energy prices continue to go up, and that's leading to, you know, rising gasoline prices, rising prices for heating fuel. But that will moderate. And the reason it will moderate over time is because, you know, again, every, you know, businesses, consumers who are traveling, that demand for oil and gas is going up, and that's leading to very large price increases for those goods. Prior to this month, it was used cars because of the chip shortage coming from foreign manufacturers of computer chips that are used in new cars. Consumers shifted their demand to used cars. So used car prices have gone up over 30% over the past year, but this was the first month where that started to moderate. So this is not a concern for me as an economist. It's a concern for a lot of people who are seeing the cost of the goods they buy, like gasoline and food and rent, going up, and their paychecks aren't increasing at the same rate. So that's problematic. But the good news is that this, you know, short-term pain of higher costs is likely going to moderate over the next year. Now, Republicans specifically have latched on to this sharp increase in inflation by saying Biden's, you know, investment in human resources, his American Families Plan, the $3.5 trillion investment in education, climate, healthcare, and so on, that because of higher inflation, we can't have more government spending. And that is disingenuous at minimum, that Biden's plan is stretched out over a decade. So it's not like, you know, we're just opening the floodgates and there's going to be an extra $3.5 trillion of spending circulating in the economy. That's spaced out over a decade. The important thing to note about the American Families Plan, or the investment in the country's human infrastructure, is that it's not a stimulus plan. It is not designed to increase economic growth over the next couple years. This is a long-term plan that is designed to increase growth over the next couple decades. This investment is long overdue. you know, expanding Medicare, addressing climate change, addressing immigration, providing universal pre-K and two-year community college, forcing firms to provide paid family and medical leave. All of this is overdue. These are investments we should have been making on an annual basis for the past 4 or 5 decades. And what you're, so this is good for the U.S. economy. This is the most, this is the largest and most needed expansion of the social safety net really since the New Deal, because it touches every aspect of people's lives from pre-kindergarten up to college and up to their working and retirement years. And what you're hearing from Republicans and opponents of this plan, including Democrats like our favorite Joe Manchin, is that this is too large of a spending bill. It's going to lead to more inflation. It's going to create a generation of people who were hooked on the government. Were people saying that, you know, the GI Bill, which provided education subsidies to soldiers in World War II, was going to create a generation of people hooked on the government, or that Eisenhower's creation and expansion of the interstate highway system is going to hook people on the government? That's just entirely disingenuous and is largely a scare tactic. What we're doing is investing in future generations. We're trying to make the economy that they inherit larger and more prosperous and cleaner, and providing them a safety net when they experience unemployment. So Biden's spending plan is not robbing future generations. Mm. It's if it goes through, it will largely enrich future generations by investing in the things that make their lives easier and more productive for the economy.
Judith, any comments on that?
No, I mean, I think Aaron is spot on in, you know, talking about a brighter future. Like, you know, maybe kids will survive climate change. So that seems like a pretty wise investment to me.
not bad. David?
Well, you know, I think the lesson to be learned here, I think the benefit for people like me, and again, your listeners, Joe, is the fact that you have two incredible educators that teach you something every time you turn the radio on. But I think the last year and a half, we've learned so many lessons. And the one lesson that I want to point out is the fact that the inextricable relationship between a healthy and strong economy and a healthy and strong family. You know, the economy suffers when schools shut down and parents have to be home and not out in the workforce, or to the extent that they're not working from home. I think when you see, you know, families that are supported, families that don't have to worry about childcare, I think you see very productive people. And at the root of this economic plan is that desire to really strengthen families. You know, the pre-K opportunities for young children. I mean, every study, yep, that you come across discusses the future productivity and the success of children if you're starting them in the educational system earlier. Paid family leave. I mean, people that want to grow their families, but are unable to do so because of you know, living from paycheck to paycheck. So, you know, I keep my fingers crossed that we do see the kind of seismic shift and investment in middle-class families in this country, because middle-class families are the backbone and the strength of this economy.
Alan, I was going to ask you, that seemed that the president was trying to do a reset yesterday on this whole social safety net, his build back better plan. So how do you think that's going? I mean, just this, the fact that there's a reason that he needed to reset, I mean, says something to us, but how effective can that be?
Well, you're right. It's a very complicated system. We have people who call up and say, don't say anything good about Richie Neal, Alan. What are you talking about? Well, Richie Neal goes right to what David Soares was just talking about. If he wants to get pre-K for everybody, if he wants to get everything set so that we can have the most for the most people, he has to make these deals. Now, of course, it's easy enough for a liberal person to sit back and say, I'm holding my nose. I don't like you, Ellen, and I don't like Richie Neal. Nevertheless, Neal is doing the work that has to be done to achieve all those things that David Soares just talked to us about. Now, do I mind people saying, okay, I don't like the fact that the Congress is sanctioning some stuff that I don't like? I think that it is terrible that they're doing that. But right now, we got to move forward, and we got a plan.
Aaron.
I wanted to build on something David said, actually. The current, you know, generation of high school and college students, the ones that are preparing to enter the workforce, are more likely now to have a lower standard of living than their parents did. And that is the first time in modern economic history Wow. where downward economic mobility is a more likely outcome than upward economic mobility. Part of that is by design. The federal government not addressing the rising cost of education, the federal government not addressing a lot of issues. But, you know, the fact that it's more likely now that people who are entering the workforce will move down the economic ladder relative to where their parents were reinforces the point that this isn't an investment in the human resources of this country that will enrich future generations, allow for a bigger economy, while also addressing issues like climate change and healthcare. And that's a major step forward. I think it's easy to get, I think that's easy to kind of get lost in the details about what this plan is, instead of taking a step back and saying, this is a huge expansion of the social safety net, larger than anything we've seen since the Great Depression and the New Deal. And that should really, I mean, Democrats should be just pounding their fists and saying, this needs to happen or else the economy and the world that future generations are going to inherit is going to be, you know, futile, for lack of a better term, where it's just, you know, poverty for, and, you know, subsistence wages for the, you know, the bottom 50% of the population. And you have a very wealthy, enriched elite siphoning all of the growth for themselves. And that is just – that is not the future I think anybody except the richest 1% really want.
So the big question I have on that subject, and David, I'll ask you, is are Democrats ready to do that?
You know, Democrats have to just stop and demonstrate some courage here and take decisive action that will move our country forward. You know, we saw a lot of this when President Obama was discussing, you know, the health care plan, right? Obamacare, just the hand wringing and the dithering, the concerns, speaking as if they weren't Democrats and speaking as if they were, you know, moderate Republican. I understand the politics. I get it. And I understand where Joe Manchin comes from. But Joe Manchin has the opportunity, as does Kristen Sinema. They have the opportunity right now to make history, to make history. And it doesn't mean that they're diving off of a political cliff. Yes, there'll be blowback, but there'll be other opportunities for them should Republicans take their seat. But we are at a critical moment right now where we could literally change the lives for millions of people. And the idea that we won't do it because we're falling prey to the economic, you know, myths that Aaron has just, you know, managed to explain to us is just unforgivable.
David Soares on the Roundtable Panel on Friday, September 17th. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.